Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, the 10th canto, 2nd chapter, Prayers by the Demigods for Lord Krishna in the Womb. This is text number 14. Translation. Thus instructed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Yogamaya immediately agreed when, with the Vedic mantra, Om, she confirmed that she would do what he asked. Thus, having accepted the order, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, she circumambulated him and started for the place on earth known as Nanda Gokula. There she did everything just as she had been told. The purport by Srila Prabhupada. After receiving the orders of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Yogamaya twice confirmed her acceptance by saying, "Yes, sir, I shall do as you order," and then saying, "Om." Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments that Om signifies Vedic confirmation. Thus, Yogamaya very faithfully received the Lord's order as Vedic injunction. It is a fact that whatever is spoken by the Supreme Personality of Godhead is a Vedic injunction that no one should neglect. In Vedic injunctions, there are no mistakes, illusions, cheating, or imperfection. Unless one understands the authority of the Vedic version, there is no purpose in quoting Shastra. No one should violate the Vedic injunction. Rather, one should strictly execute the order given in the Vedas. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 16:24, Tasmat Shastram Pramanam Te Karya 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 Vyavastitao Jnatva Shastra Vidanoktam Karma Kartam Iharasi. One should understand what is duty and what is not duty by the regulations of the scriptures. Knowing such rules and regulations, one should act so that one may gradually be elevated. Sandishta Evam Bhagavata Tata iti om iti tadvachaha prithviya parikramya gamgata tat tata karot. Thus instructed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Yogamaya immediately agreed. With the Vedic mantra Om, she confirmed that she would do what he asked. Thus, having accepted the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, she circumambulated him and started for the place on earth known as Nanda Gokula. There she did everything just as she had been told. So now the conclusion of instruction. Yogamaya has appeared and the Lord has given her some orders. Who can recount what those were? Yes, Douglas.
Well, the tough one was to transfer Balaram to Sankushan from the woman of Devaki to the
woman. Yeah, who is Rohini? Huh? They're the wife. And where is she? Where's Rohini? Yeah, she's in the care of Nanda. And so, in other words, Devaki is pregnant, and that And Balaram is there in her womb. So she's now supposed to move Balaram from Devaki's womb to Rohini's womb. Right? It's one way to get him out of prison. And then, as we'll see, it'll appear to everybody that Devaki had a miscarriage because she was pregnant and then she wasn't. But what had actually happened is the child was transferred. Okay, so what's the other order? There was another thing they told her to do.
She's supposed to take birth.
Or manifest herself. In, yeah. Yeah. Where? Oh, it doesn't say that here. He says, what it says that he says to go there. He says. Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, he says to go there, transfer Shankarshan, and then he says you will appear as the mother, as the daughter of Mother Yashoda. Yeah, and he puts it in the form of, yeah, but he says the order is to go there, and then, yeah, transfer Shankarshan, and then what else? He says that she will be manifest. Manifest in many other places. In the form of a blessing, he says you'll be worshipped here and there, and so apparently at this time also. She became manifest in different other places also under those different names that he gave. Huh?
So Yogamaya took birth as Yashoda's daughter.
Yeah.
Is that same as
Subhadra? Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's Subhadra.
Mm-hmm. Does she have some pastimes in Vrindavan that you've heard about?
The only pastimes I know about her are the ones in, later. But I don't know of any Vrindavan pastimes. I haven't heard them. Maybe someone else has. So anyway, she was instructed to go there and transfer Balaram and become born from Yashoda later as the younger sister of Krishna, and then also to receive worship all over the world as Maya Devi. And so she agrees to these instructions. This agreement is the subject of discussion here in the purport. Her agreement is mentioned here, tata iti om iti. So twice, tata means, well, as we would say, okay. Yes, sir. Promise. And tata, so be it. Yes, I will do as you say. Yes, sir. Tata, and then om. And then the om also, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, indicates assent or confirmation, Vedic confirmation. So that is, he is accepting his instructions, tat vachaha, those words, with the word om, which indicate that they are the same as the injunction of the Vedas. Thus Yogamaya very faithfully received the Lord's order as a Vedic injunction. So this is the important point here. An injunction means those things which are ought to be done. Actually, in Sanskrit, there's a separate form of verb for injunction. It's called vidhi lin. Lin means a particular form of a verb, and vidhi means injunction. So, just as in English we have the word ought. You ought to do this, you ought to do that. Yeah, it's kind of gone out of style. You don't hear it anymore very much. But when we say in English you ought to do something, it means something that you should do, but not just because for convenience sake, but something you should do because it is a moral or a religious necessity. So usually when we say ought in English, you ought to repay your debts, you ought to honor your parents, you ought, so that's the word ought is used like that. So in Sanskrit that sense is conveyed by the this vidhi lin. Tad vigyanartham sagurum evabhigachet. See that lin, that the evabhigachet is vidhi lin ending. In order to understand that knowledge, then one ought to accept spiritual master. But this ought doesn't mean optional. It means you are obliged to do it because of the force of injunction, this Vedic injunction. So anyway, there's that special verbal endings for vidhi lin in Sanskrit. So these are the Vedic injunctions which are given for the regulation of human society. And they're not to be considered something that we can dispute about or argue with, because the Vedas are apurusheya. They are not produced by any mundane person. Our moral nowadays moral injunctions are considered to be arbitrary, the product of evolutionary or historical forces. The German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche in the 19th century wrote a book called The Genealogy of Morals, which shocked everybody, because he was suggesting that that morals are not permanent and immutable, but are subjected to historical and causative forces. So we all are taught up that way nowadays, that religious injunctions or morals are really a relative matter, and are put into place by people with various motives, or arise out of various historical circumstances, and you only follow them insofar as you need to, not to get into trouble. For example, if you can get away with it, then you can. But actually, and of course you can find more rules like that. That's not to say that there are various civilizations that are basically concoctions. And almost for the last 5,000 years, everything has become concocted because people have forgotten how to follow. So here Prabhupada wants to say that Vedic injunctions, there are no mistakes, illusions, cheating or imperfection, apurusheya, they are not produced. They are not, when it says apurusheya, means no conditioned soul manufactured them. So that they are not the product of various sorts of social, historical, economic, and political forces. They're not some disguised rules promulgated by an upper class, designed to keep that class in power and everybody else subjugated, and so on like that. And there are no, as he said, these are the four, anything that is produced by a human being is subjected to these difficulties that any person, that any conditioned soul makes mistakes. Any conditioned soul becomes subject to illusion. Any conditioned soul is imperfect in knowing. The senses that we have are limited and imperfect. So we produce and generate various theories of knowledge, but we haven't got the faintest notion of what's really going on, or very, very little bit. There is maybe so much more in the universe than we can ever possibly imagine. Imagine the condition of a fly, for example. And there's a fly buzzing around this room. I'll say this, just when I was driving from Gidinagri, there was a fly trapped in the car. So there was a little universe of the fly was inside this car. But the car is moving along at 60 miles an hour on a highway. And outside is the state of Pennsylvania. He has no knowledge that outside is, first of all, this whole scenery going by at 60 miles an hour. This is his universe, the inside of the car. He doesn't understand the car. Doesn't understand outside there's this land. He doesn't understand the United States government. For example, all those things are there, they're in the universe. What does the fly know about these things? So we may be in a similar position. The fly has his senses, which are very good for the purposes of the fly. You know, he's got that compound eye with so many facets, and so the slightest motion he can detect, that's why they're very hard to catch. So for his little purposes, the fly is expertly equipped. But for understanding the whole universe, what does he know? So human beings are not very well equipped. The same idea. Sariputta gives the example of there's an ant sitting on these tiles here, and it's sitting right here. And it walks around a little bit and notices there's this pattern of black and white tiles or intersecting lines. And he makes a series. Theory of the universe, this goes out forever and ever and ever and so on. So people have a little bit of experience, and on the basis of that little bit of experience, they try to generalize and make up universal laws without any notion whatsoever that even the senses we have may only pick up a little bit of what there may be all kinds of things going on beyond our range of our senses, even though we can extend our senses a little bit with various instruments, and we know that there's infrared light and radiation, infrared radiation and ultraviolet radiation that our eyes cannot see, and that's there, so we have a little indication of that. And there's sounds that are pitched too high that we can't hear, but that dogs can hear, for example. And so in various ways we extend our senses, but still, they're limited. And so whatever knowledge we put forward on the basis of these limited senses, and by the fact that we just blunder all the time, everyone's always making mistakes in what we do and how we assess situation, our judgment is often bad. Illusions means that we mistake one thing for another. The standard example is when you can see a mother of pearl and think it is gold, or silver rather, looks just like silver. Or they're going to a dark shed and there's a rope in the corner and you see a snake. I don't even know if anyone's actually had an experience like that. But it's not that you see a shape. It's not like when you have an illusion like this that you see this coiled cylinder, rope, this coiled thing in the corner, and you think, man, that might be a snake. You look at it and you see a snake. You can see the eyes, you can see the scales. And then you look again and you realize, oh, but the first thing you see is a snake. It's definitely a snake. Anytime you've had an experience of actually mistaking one thing for something else, somehow or other your mind actually imposes on the object the full-fledged form of the thing. This is illusion. We are frequently an illusion. And we have a habit of seeing things that actually aren't there, even whether it's directly something or other illusions about what's going on, what's happening with people around us and things like that. We see things, we assess things. So then the final defect is cheating. The fact that we are very imperfect and limited, that we are subject to illusions, even in the things we do see, we assess them incorrectly, that we make mistakes all the time. In spite of all this, I still will stand up and declare myself an expert and give people definitive directions on what to do. I'll write advice columns, I'll become an expert witness, I'll become a professor, and so on. I'll be known as an expert in this field or that field. And it's all a bluff. That's called cheating. I don't know anything. And of course, what the experts all know is they don't know anything. This is the real truth of the matter. Is when you begin to investigate any subject, what you discover the vast areas in which you are ignorant. But now you're known to the world as an expert, so you have to keep up the expert appearance. While among your colleagues, you discuss your ignorance in confidence. This is always going on. When Prabhupada was here in Philadelphia, there was an Indian fellow, Professor Yadav, who was a professor of mine at the university, and wanted to meet Prabhupada, so I brought him. And Yadav was, although born and raised in a Vaishnava family, he was not properly situated. In fact, was an outrageous mental speculator, sort of a Buddhist at the time and everything like that. So Prabhupada said, what do you teach? And he said, Hinduism. And Prabhupada said, so what is that Hinduism? And Yadav says, I don't know. Well, this was the wrong thing to say. Prabhupada, although Yadav is telling the truth, actually, that I don't know. Prabhupada said, you are teaching and you do not know. If you do not know, he said, how can you teach? And Yadav, I forgot what his reply was to that. It was some word jugglery. Prabhupada said, I know. And Prabhupada kept his point. Do you explain to me, if you do not know something, how can you teach it? And then Bhakti Swarup Damodar was sitting there, and he said, "This is our Swarup Damodar. He's also PhD. Let us get his judgment." He turned to Bhakti Swarup Damodar and said, "What is your judgment that he does not know, but he is teaching?" Bhakti Swarup Damodar says, "Cheater, Srila Prabhupada. That is called cheater." So Prabhupada said to him, "So you have heard his judgment. You do not know, but you are teaching. That is called cheater." Then Yadav got angry, you know. Then a little later on in the conversation, he said, "Yes, it's true, I'm a cheater." He said, "It's a fact, I'm a cheater." He said, "But at least I'm an honest cheater." But Prabhupada gave him no rope. He said, "You say you are honest, but the judgment of a cheater cannot be accepted." But Yadu, he was so angry at Prabhupada, and of course, and I'm thinking, this is a professor of mine, I have to deal with this fellow tomorrow. What am I going to do? But he was quite challenging to Prabhupada, actually, and Prabhupada just wasn't going to let him get away with it. Then the subject of cheating came up again when Prabhupada, he asked Prabhupada, "What is the meaning of Sharanam Braja, surrender? What is the meaning of Sharanam Braja? What is the meaning of surrender?" And Prabhupada said, turned to his assistant and said, "Hand me the dictionary." So Yadav bristled at that and said, "I want the Sanskrit etymological meaning of Sharanam Braja." And Prabhupada said, "You should leave." He said, "We can't waste our time like this." He said, "You don't want a spiritual master, you want a Sanskrit teacher." Spiritual master means you have to inquire submissively. Tadvidi pranipatena paripashnena sevaya. He said, "That's what you have to do." He said, "First you become shaven-headed like these." Then Yadav said, "No, I'm asking, I'm submissive." He said, I'm asking you, what is Hinduism? I'm asking you. You tell me." And he said, "I cannot tell you. You have to become submissive. Tadvidi pranipatena. First you become shaven-headed like these. Then I will instruct you," he said. Tadvidi pranipatena. Then he said, Yadav said, "I did. When I came in, I offered my pranams." Then Prabhupada said, "So my first instruction to you is stop this cheating business." But he said. So anyway, there was a cheater that he didn't know. It's true, he didn't know. Nobody knows. Even people who teach Hinduism, they've not got the faintest idea. Because I talked to various devotees who have gone to and going to graduate school. And, you know, we meet people, like if you go to university, they'll give you dates. The Bhagavad Gita was done at such and such a time. They give you Bhagavatam, they'll say 9th century AD. Anyway, they give you different dates. But what you find out is when you start to dig up and find out what is the structure upon which they rest these datings, is it all dissolves into air. There's a whole theory of the Aryan invasion. And, you know, that their theory is that there were some kind of native people down there in India, Dravidians. And then from up north somewhere, they're not sure where, these Indo-European people invaded. These people, this war god, war gods, and they invaded India. Others went west, and went into Europe and became the Greeks and the Romans. And others went down into India, and these Indo-Europeans fought the Dravidians, and out of the intermix of their civilization. And so they have all these theories that Shiva was originally a Dravidian god and got incorporated into the Indo-European pantheon, and all this. Anyway, you don't need to hear it. But the whole thing is based on this theory of this Indo-European invasion. Well, there's no history of such a thing. It was never written down. And when I took an anthropology of India course, you would call it science fiction. You know, there's a few little potsherds, various cities they've dug up, and it's a theory that's got the most flimsy sort of factual basis. The actual concrete facts, as you see them, they're barely there at all. And if somebody wanted to go in and blow the whole thing up, you could do it very easily. But just that such a big structure has been built on it now, it's too hard to give up. So anyway, devotees who are going to graduate school now and finding out, becoming themselves experts, are discovering what the experts just don't know. It's just really what they say with confidence in the textbooks and everything like that. They'll turn around and among themselves say, we haven't got the foggiest notion. Yeah?
I read recently a book in which he was discussing the dating of these different things, like why the dates are so recent. He said because most of those Europeans who were doing the dating, they were trying to fit it into the Mosaic framework where the whole universe began 4,004 BC.
Yeah. Sure. Originally they came with a Christian idea, and the world was supposed to be created in 4004 BC, so they had to fit it in there. Now that 4004 BC is gone, but still they've got the results of that. That's one thing. So anyway, these are the imperfections, and if you've gone into it enough, if you've ever had the chance to become an expert in any field of academic knowledge, it does wonders for your faith in the Vedas. That's all. Anything that an academic says, you can understand that in a few years. Anyway, this is what he says it is now. In a few years, somebody equally authoritative will come along and reject it. Most fields of knowledge, it's like that. The Vedic version means it is not created by these historical processes. Now, of course, they have a theory. The theory is there's nothing on earth that is not created by an historical process. That's what they say. How do you know? They don't know. In fact, there's no way to test it. It's just a working assumption. And what's the basis of this working assumption? Well, ultimately, that there is no God. How do you know that there is no God? Well, you know, that's a decision that they've made. They even say, well, yeah, I can believe in God, but still. As a scientist or as a scholar, as a researcher, we have to keep it out, and so on. But this was there. You can say that some things you just make a decision. So one decision is there is no God. Another decision, there is. So anyway, our society is following the Vedic version. And
the decision, which one do you accept or not accept? Here, Prabhupada quotes this verse from the 16th chapter. Does anybody know what the 16th chapter is about? What is it? Divine and demonic natures. So Krishna in this chapter is describing those who are divine and those who are demonic. The big divide. You know, there are two kinds of created beings in this world. Some are divine and some are demonic. And then he describes their various characteristics. And then at the end of that chapter, the final two verses, he says, ultimately, how we can see the difference between the divine and the demonic. And there's these two verses. He who discards the scriptural injunctions, ya shastra vidim utsrija, shastra vidim, the injunction of the scripture. Utsrija means casts aside, discards, throws away. He who throws away scriptural injunctions and acts according to his own whim, kama karataha, acts according to lust, his own desire, his own, well, Prabhupada says, this is called acting whimsically, when you follow not your, so either you're following shastra vidim or kama karata, you act according to lust. And acts according to his own whims, attains neither perfection, nor happiness, nor the supreme destination. The Sanskrit's very nice. Na sa siddhim avapnoti, he attains no perfection. Na sukham, no happiness. Na param gatim, nor the supreme destination. You blow it. You blow it for this life, and you blow it in the next life. And then the verse that Prabhupada quotes here in the purport, therefore, tasmat, therefore, shastram pramanam te. You should, karya akarya vyavastitaha. You should determine what is karya and akarya, what is to be done and what is not to be done. Shastram pramanam, on the evidence of shastra. Knowing such rules and regulations, one should act in this world so that you will become elevated. So the difference is really, that's the divine. The ultimate thing is those who are godly accept the injunction of shastra, and those who are ungodly reject and act according to kama karata, act according to their own whim, or they act according to lust. So although many worshippers or followers of Durga may be acting whimsically, Yogamaya herself, she's a devotee, she says tata iti omiti tadvajaha pratigraha. Accepted his order and so executed. So, any questions? The issue is from which, from whom, from what source do our orders come from? Who is the authority for our actions? That authority for our actions, we have to accept, has to come from shastra, shastra-vidya, and we have to be ruled and directed by shastra. Otherwise, concoction. Yeah.
So if somebody's not fixed in their determination, does that have directly to do with that they have not authority in which they fully believe in? Is that the essence of their lack of determination?
Yeah, sure. One has to accept this authority and follow it. Of course, sometimes we try to serve two masters. What does it say? You cannot serve both God and mammon. Huh? You cannot serve both Krishna and lust. It doesn't work. People are get torn, you know, Krishna Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and lust Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, whatever. But ultimately, we have to get off the mental platform. Getting off, when we say get off the mental platform, means not to think, well, maybe I'll follow Krishna, maybe I'll follow Maya, maybe I'll do this, maybe I'll do. You have to say, this is what Krishna says, and I'm going to do it. This is called intelligence. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.